I'm calling to order the Elections Finance and Government Operations Committee. Is anyone interested in moving the minutes? Chair Freiberg.
I'll move approval of the minutes of the February 25th meeting of the Elections Finance and Government Operations Committee.
Any questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. And I will move House File 2614 before the committee. And would the authors please take a seat and introduce yourselves.
You Thank you, proceed. Mr. Chair. Did you already move this? And did you refer it to housing?
I moved it before the committee.
Okay,
and
there you go.
Then you'll present it. I understand there's a desire to do an amendment. And when we're done, I will make the motion, if the committee goes for it, to approve as amended and move it on to the housing committee.
Very good. So House File 2614, Mr. Chair and committee members, is a pretty simple bill, and I do have a DE amendment that I would like to move first so it can get the bill in the shape we want it.
Anyone have any objection to? Okay. I would move that we amend House File 2614 with the DE1 amendment. All in favor, and put it in the form at which the author prefers. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. It is so amended. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can see, I have my colleague, Representative Bonner, sitting with me because this is a bipartisan bill. What this basically says is that a local unit of government cannot force or require an amenity that would then create an HOA or force the need for an HOA. Does not mean that the developer cannot put one in, does not mean that the developer can't, he's free to do what he or she's free to do whatever they wish, it just so that it can't be mandated. Perhaps Representative Bonner would like to comment briefly.
I will just add a little additional context for this bill. This language is part of a much larger bill, as many of you know, on CIC HOA reform that's been in the works for about 2 years now. From its inception through a work group, a series of recommendations that came out of that work group, hundreds of potential change requests from everyone from everyday citizens to folks on the bar, legal aid, the Housing Justice Center, Housing First, individual lawyers, et cetera, and we entertained no potential request for change was denied. We looked at them all. All of the things in that larger bill are the result of an agreement between all four parties in the House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans. This specific section of the bill is a little bit different in that it needed to come directly here, so we wanted to keep things moving, so we brought this individual piece to you, since this is the part that is in your jurisdiction. This specific small portion, we actually negotiated the language on this with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I believe Mr. Lightfoot is probably in the wings somewhere. He may certainly wish to speak to it as well, but we went back and forth and traded various offers to address some concerns that cities brought forward, as well as the League of Minnesota Cities, and we arrived at this compromise language. It has been the same language we've had for about a year now, and it is the same language that passed out of the Senate with a two-thirds supermajority as well. All we are doing today is amending that language to make sure that it matches everywhere else and make sure that it gets heard. Here, and our request is to bring it to housing. My understanding is there may be other HOA provisions moving that I was made aware of late last week. that are going into housing, so they would all be in one place and those conversations can move forward. Certainly, you know, if there's additional suggestions to make the language better, we are happy to work with anyone at any time. We've done so in good faith throughout this process and would continue to do that as well. I will also say a personal apology to Chair Akam. We had been hoping to connect in person this morning, but it sounds like our schedules kept missing. So I didn't get to talk to you in person. So I just wanted to say that while I had the opportunity. And with that, we are certainly open for any questions on the bill. I'm sorry. Test fires. We'll let you do that, Mr. Chair.
And I see two testifiers listed, Mark Foster and Roxanne Kimball. If you can approach, identify yourself and your organization, and then proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Quam, Chair Freiberg, and members of the committee. My name is Mark Foster, and I serve as the Vice President of Legislative and Political Affairs for Housing First Minnesota. Housing First Minnesota is a trade group representing nearly 1,000 members of the housing industry. Our mission is to advance home ownership opportunities for all Minnesotans. Our members are the builders and developers who serve as declarants of homeowners associations and are responsible for the creation and establishment of HOAs and new residential developments. Thank you to Representative Meckland and Representative Bonner for introducing this bill and for incorporating the amendment that was discussed with stakeholders in the Senate late last session. We also appreciate the committee's time and consideration today. Just a brief background on this bill and HOAs. It's been discussed in prior hearings and within the Homeowners Association Working Group that more than 80% of new home construction in Minnesota is part of a homeowners association. As the declarants who create these associations, we believe that number is too high. We must right-size the use of HOAs moving forward. So, not to beat on HOAs completely, though, they serve an important and appropriate role in certain types of housing. Villa products designed for low-maintenance living, communities with shared amenities such as clubhouses and pools, and townhomes with shared walls and roofs all require an HOA structure. That should and will continue under this language. However, outside of these housing types, many homebuyers are not seeking to live in an HOA, and our members would often prefer not to create them. Too frequently, the formation of common property, and therefore an HOA, is driven by local government requirements, sometimes with the expectation that the HOA will own or maintain infrastructure that would otherwise be public. Homebuyers bear the cost of this dynamic, and ongoing HOA dues increase monthly housing expenses and reduce purchasing power, limiting how many Minnesotans can achieve home ownership. At a time when our state faces both a housing shortage and an affordability crisis, we need to focus on building more homes, not creating more unnecessary HOAs. Current state law already requires the creation of HOAs when they are necessary. This proposal does not change any of that. HOAs will continue to be formed when they are appropriate and essential. What this legislation addresses are the loopholes that allow local governments to effectively mandate HOAs by requiring unnecessary common property. By closing these loopholes, this bill will help reduce the number of HOAs created in new construction and support housing affordability across Minnesota. This legislation is one of a number of meaningful practical proposals we are asking the committee to support this session to address housing supply and affordability. We believe it represents a thoughtful, targeted reform that can make a real difference for future home buyers across the state. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Do any members have questions for this specific testifier? Thank you, Mr. Foster and Ms. Kimball. Again, your name and association, and then proceed.
Of course. Hello, Chair Kwan, Chair Freiberg, and members of the committee. My name is Roxanne Young Kimball. I'm the president of the Minnesota Homeownership Center. We're a statewide nonprofit that supports equitable, sustainable homeownership through education, homeownership advising, and policy work. I served on the working group, and I thank Representatives Bonner and Meckland for their leadership on the issue of HOAs in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today in support of House File 2614. This legislation prevents counties and cities from requiring or incentivizing the creation of homeownership associations as a condition of approving residential building permits, subdivisions, or planned unit developments. This bill addresses a growing problem testified to in the legislative working group. Some cities have used HOA mandates as a way to shift public infrastructure costs, like streets, curbs, sidewalks, or stormwater systems, onto homeowners. Residents end up paying full property taxes and HOA dues for what should be municipal responsibilities. Others require privately maintained trails or amenities that in most communities would be part of a public trail or park system. These practices increase housing costs and reduce supply. Developers and housing advocates consistently report that unnecessary HOAs, particularly for single-family detached homes, add cost, complexity, and delay, making it harder to build starter homes that families can afford. We've also seen the long-term harm of imposing HOAs where they aren't needed. At Heritage Park in Minneapolis, the city required an HOA as part of a planned unit development. The homes are fully detached, single-family homes, and the common elements that were intended in the planned unit development were never built. Today, the homeowners want the HOA dissolved, and the city is supportive of their intention. However, current law makes dissolution extremely difficult, another reason to avoid creating unnecessary HOAs in the first place. This bill ensures HOAs are created only when they serve a real purpose to manage common property, not because the city requires them. It protects homeowners from double taxation, reduces unnecessary development costs, and supports more affordable homeownership statewide. This bill also aligns with the companion legislation addressing HOA dissolution for situations like Heritage Park and Senate File 1750. For these reasons, I respectfully urge your support of House File 2614. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. I did have one clarification because we do have the public listening. If you're a member of the HOA, do you pay the same no matter what the value of your home is?
That is my understanding from the working group, yes.
Okay, so the people listening, it's a fee. Unlike property taxes, which are based on the value of your property, it's the same for everyone. And that isn't a trivial point. Any questions from members? Representative Roach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys for bringing this forward. I'm reading the original language and then the DE language, and I notice in the original you had some, essentially you kept the county from being able to put the mandates down. Is there a reason why it's removed in the DE, just so I?
Yeah.
Ms. Our Representative Bonner.
Thank you. It was my understanding that through additional conversations that in the way that these things actually work, that counties do not have as much of a role in that is one of the considerations that came forward. And we kind of walked through this with the League of Minnesota Cities and other groups and so forth, as well as the counties. And this is kind of where we landed on that issue. I don't know if Ms. Kimball might have additional light to shed on that.
Ms. Kimball, did you have a comment?
No, I don't.
Okay.
A follow-up?
I don't have a whole lot of insight into it. Was just curious. I mean, if they don't have a whole lot of say over it, I guess, I mean, I really like the language from the get-go, and I think we need to, you know, solve it regardless. Obviously, we've got a lot of, you know, increased cost of housing. So I was just curious where the counties were on that, why they would push back on that so much if they don't really have much say in it anyways.
Yeah.
Representative Bonner. Yep. Or Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you look at, where is it here, lines 1.4 through 1.6, county is listed in there as well. And to Representative Bonner's point, when you have this many different entities that all have different pieces of heartburn somewhere, this was the best we could come up with. I believe Mr. Lightfoot is in here somewhere. we had about this last week, and trying to just find some peace in the valley for all parties involved.
Yeah. And I was wondering, maybe we could get clarification from nonpartisan staff.
Chair Quam and members, as Representative Mecklen stated, county is included in the definition of local government. You can see it on line 1.5 of the Delete Everything Amendment.
If that takes care of Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, question for Representative Mecklen. What was the creation of this? Why is this bill bringing forward to prohibit a city from or having the ability to prohibit an HOA?
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Mr. Foster stated, 80% of all new developments have an HOA assigned to them. This has become a growing problem. A lot of them then default to a property management company. We just had a case that one of our members in Burnsville had where the HOA on single family homes decided that they all needed new roofs. They did not look at the roofs individually, one at a time. They just took it. Once they found a couple bad ones, they were all bad. Now, where this particular case became more egregious, they were all assessed $17,000. I don't know how many homeowners out there that just have 17 grand laying around, because most people don't. But in this particular case, they did an ACH withdrawal out of one of those homeowners' bank account without the homeowner's knowledge or approval. And that leads to a whole new set of questions, which my understanding is the AG's office is very interested in this particular case. But these are the things that we are seeing repeatedly. And as Mr. Foster pointed out, if it's a shared walls, if it's a shared roofing system, if it's got the clubhouse, the pool, all of that's going to be required. If the developer wants it, nothing prevents him from or her from doing it. It just simply states that a local unit of government cannot mandate a amenity, which could be nothing more than a stone that says, you know, River's Crest or something, which just something that simple that needs to be now mowed around. And nor would it, and in some cases where a homeowner said, just put it in my yard and don't do the HOA in the planning side of it. Nope, they don't want that. They want it on a separate piece of land, so that it requires that piece of land to be mowed, and they don't want the responsibility. So that's where this comes from. Representative McDonald.
Follow up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Representative Mecklen. Yeah, you and I have spoke to this. I teed that up, and the reason why I wanted to share a quick story with a constituent in Waite and Montrose, I believe, called me in July. And he has a couple of kids. He has a beautiful backyard fenced in, and his HOA in Montrose wouldn't allow him to have any playgrounds in the backyard, and complained if they had a kid's toys in his grass and his piece of property, and then went on to explain several other formidable problems with an HOA that you mentioned, and so did Ms. Kimball, and so did the other testifier. So I think our HOAs have gotten to a point where they seem to have received too much authority and very authoritarian to people that own their own property and homes. So I think this is a very important piece of legislation. When a homeowner is not allowed by his HOA to have his children's play equipment, be it a little slide or a little house, in his backyard in the summertime, we got a problem. Houston, Minnesota, Montrose, we got a problem. And then find if he left the kids' toys. Isn't that ridiculous? So thank you for bringing this forward. But I do have a question regarding lines 1.12 and 1.13. It could be for Ms. Griffin or Ms. Representative Bonner or Mecklen. And when it says inclusion of any service, feature, or common property necessitating a homeowners association unless requested by the developer. Now, our developers are creating these beautiful homes and developments in our communities, and we want them to be beautiful developments. What exactly does that mean in that those two, 1.12 and 1.13?
I think I'll ask nonpartisan staff for clarity.
Chair Quam and members, as I read that clause, I think it's stating that as part of the application, the developer is requesting that this service or feature or common property be included, and perhaps a homeowners association would would be a part of this specific development.
Thank you. Was that clarity
Mr.
enough?
Chair. Yeah, thank you. So, Ms. Griffin, would that include, like I live in Westridge Hills, and it's good you can say, well, just go up County Road 30 and take a left by the water tower, and we're in Westridge Hills. So does that give the developer an opportunity to have a stone that has to be mowed around, a stone or a sign that states what neighborhood or development that they're in? Does that give the developer an opportunity to tell the city council we want this approved?
Ms. Griffin?
Chair Quam and Representative McDonald, that I think that that would be a possibility under this language. It's not the local government that's requiring the feature. It would be the developer that's asking for it.
To the author, a clarification of your understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, that is what I said earlier. It does not prohibit the developer from wanting it or requesting it, and that's what this line is pointing out, that they can still implement the HOA if they want to. So that's the reason for it.
Yes. Representative Akam.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate the opportunity to talk about this bill a little bit. First, I want to say I agree with Representative McDonald in terms of over-restrictive HOA regulations, in particular when they referred to solar panels. We got that changed so that they cannot prevent them from being put on within HOAs. So I do think there are a lot of places where HOAs have overly tight restrictions. And I know this language to the authors reflects long conversations and some of the change. I appreciate some of the changes that you've made. I am aware that there was conversation about stormwater, and I'm disappointed that that isn't included in this. And so as you continue to work on this bill, I hope that you'll consider that. And I say that because my city is fully developed, and within our city, we have hundreds of stormwater ponds, that many of which are in HOAs. And so to take that cost of maintaining stormwater ponds, because they do need to be maintained, and socialize that cost on all taxpayers feels somewhat unfair, since the stormwater pond comes from a subdivision development. And so there's one going on in my community now, and you can see where they're building the stormwater pond. And so that coming back and the rest of us having to pay for a cost that was caused by the development feels unfair. And in my community, as I talked about the hundreds of stormwater ponds that we have, I think they said it's about $100,000 a piece to maintain them. And so you can see that that cost, which would then end up on property taxes, and I know we're all feeling pretty vulnerable or impacted by increased property taxes. And so I have some heartburn with the way this particular provision or the prohibition around cities requiring a stormwater. And so I reached out to Nonpartisan over the weekend to ask if there are other alternatives, or what the alternatives or what mechanisms could be used in order to ensure that these stormwater ponds and infrastructure is maintained. And so they shared that either it can be through a contract with the developer, who will no longer be a part of this subdivision or the homes, or it can be done by the cities. And I think that when we're putting all of that on city taxpayers for the benefit of a subdivision, especially at a time when we are looking to increase density in our state that is a water-rich state, stormwater ponds are going to be in a lot of places. And so we need to make sure they're maintained to protect our water quality. And it is my opinion, and certainly that of my cities, that that cost be borne by the group that caused it. And so, you know, maybe what I will say as Representative Bonner indicated that there's willingness to consider ideas. I know this was has been talked about before and a part of the conversation. And so I hope that as you continue to work on this bill, that that will be included. But because of the impacts that it will have in many of our communities on all of our taxpayers, I'm going to ask for a roll call, please.
A roll call has been requested. Just for some clarification, when I was growing up and I was in high school, there was a major flood in Rochester. I lived out in the country, and I helped dig the, you know, buckets of water and mud out of the basements, and there was an organized stormwater and drainage program for the entire county and city together. And there was actually, whenever there was development, people were required to have those retention ponds and et cetera in there. So it wasn't an option that they, an HOA type group said, oh, geez, this would be wonderful for our area. It was required. So I believe there's more complexity depending on what location you're in. If the county or the city is requiring these type of facilities, that might be treated a little bit differently than if it was just decided by the individuals. And I understand that the county and city pay for the maintaining of it, so they have control over the quality, and they have prevented many floods from happening because of that organized development. So there's a function for more than just that one entity for that. And I'll let the authors now address this question.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. I want to say this one is a little bit tricky in that, you know, when we were talking about this, we certainly don't want to stop, you know, if you have a community of pickleball enthusiasts from wanting to build a development that includes a pickleball court, right? We certainly don't want to tell them they can't. We just don't want the city to have to require it. But that said, this is interesting in that we talk about the way, so I was doing a little digging and on my homework here, in the way that we handle infrastructure, right? So pickleball, I think we could argue, is a common element that is discretionary, right? Probably not necessary. But my understanding of how the building process works is that there's a couple levels at which we have to do things like checks, code reviews, what's called a grading review, where they actually do discuss sort of the placement of water, how runoff water would be treated, if they might need a retention pond or things like that. And it could vary depending on the geography, the city, different elements. You know, I will tell you, we have quite a few structures similar to this in Maple Grove. We have clay soil, and we have lots of sort of marshy areas. So we actually have quite a few. In fact, there's one across the street from my house. I tried to get a hold of my city to find out how they do that without an HOA. I have not been able to get an answer back. But what's interesting about this one is when we talk about infrastructure, when we build, we generally have the development put in and pay for the building out of internal infrastructure. So whether it's gas lines, electric, sewer, different things. And generally what happens, from my understanding, is that after that development is built, the electrical lines get handed over to the electrical company. They maintain them going forward. The same with the natural gas lines, the same with the sewer. But the water retention ponds are a bit of a conundrum because there isn't necessarily a logical owner to give it to. My understanding is that in a lot of older homes, and certainly we can verify this with other folks, but that they, a lot of cities actually, once it is built, they actually take over maintenance of that structure if it needs to be cleaned or what have you. But I do know that especially in some of the newer developments, there are agreements with various cities, and they treat it differently, who do in fact have some sort of agreement with a homeowners association. And in most cases, the water retention pond is not the only thing necessitating an HOA. Generally speaking, my understanding is that in most of those cases where the city has asked them to maintain it, they do generally have other common elements that would necessitate it. So it wouldn't just be the water retention pond. And certainly we have no concerns with that at all. I also want to draw your attention to specifically the language of the DE on lines 1.18 through 1.19. This provision was actually added also to address some of the concerns around maintenance, because we do understand that there's a balance to be had here. Now, I will tell you, there are some homeowners that came forward during the work groups and our listening sessions around the cities here that had very strong feelings that they felt that cities and counties had too much authority. But we also understand and appreciate that cities are an interesting pickle too, right? If they build parks in an HOA and suddenly that HOA goes defunct for some reason, they're on the hook for having to try to maintain and pay for it and put things into their budget that they didn't count on, right? Which isn't really fair to cities either. So the language that we put in here on 1.18 through 1.19, specifically about maintenance, was to address that very issue and make sure that we aren't just throwing things onto the responsibility of the cities as well that they didn't really budget for and that they couldn't necessarily sustain, because we wanted to try to find that balance. And we do expect that these conversations will continue and that other ideas or language may come forward as well. And it is our intent that when it moves to housing, where there's also some other conversations going on along this same vein now, that will be part of the conversation there too, to continue to work through it and see if there aren't other ways to improve the language.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up on that for a minute. Thank you. Representative Akam, there's a thing called 1, 2, and 10, and that's the warranty that a builder must put or provide to any consumer buying the product of which it is they build. Let's imagine a development, if the city didn't say they had to put in a water retention pond and the developer chose not to but should have, there's going to be a whole lot of liability when the basements start getting wet, as Chair Quam talked about, because that 10-year is for major structural defects, and there are several developments that were done in the late 80s through the early 2000s where they did not put water mitigation thought into the whole development up front, and those neighborhoods have a lot of problems, and then those builders they end up falling on that whole sword at the end. So I don't really see that being that much of a concern, because if a water retention pond is needed to prevent basements from flooding or what have you, they're going to see to it that it's there from a liability standpoint. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I think it's not whether it'll be there or not. It's who's going to maintain it and the cost and the responsibility of maintaining it. And so, and to Chair Quam's points about, city stormwater facilities versus holding ponds, there's a difference. Typically, the holding ponds or the stormwater ponds that come from building development then feed into larger stormwater pipes within the community that are there that the city does put in and maintain. And so I think there's a, different layers of the system and handled differently in different parts of our state and depending on development. But I think about some of the developments in neighboring communities that literally have a stormwater pond in the middle surrounded by homes. And so to think in some way that should be a public infrastructure to maintain when, maybe there's a fountain in the middle, whatever it might be, I think that there's a recognition that that is a part of that subdivision and that development. And so for that reason, I will continue to impress to the bill authors that including something in terms of stormwater would be important. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Akam. And there are extreme examples of what's required when a division or, addition or something's put in that has to do with water. And maybe in your part of the state that isn't being required by a governmental entity, but the ones I've been familiar with in my area are required by a governmental entity, which means that it's not up to the builder, the HMO, et cetera, whether they have it or not. And there's also requirements about maintaining those. So I hope in the future, your part of the state actually has the forethought to do the flood prevention in a planned and general manner. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would trust Representative Aiken with my stormwater planning. So I'm sure that she comes on good authority. I actually have a question for the authors, just in terms of this is a newer issue for me, but when we talk about the cities that are actually requiring an HOA as part of, or requiring common property as part of, how common is this? Like, how often are we seeing it? Is it growing, just sort of out of curiosity?
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, yes. Bottom line is, and some of it like can be, like I said, it literally can be a monument of what the name of the neighborhood is, where you could put it in somebody's yard, which some people have asked for that, and they won't do it. They carve out the little piece of property. And some of these rules, Representative Donald talked about toys in the backyard. There's one that we both talked to where she had a shed in the backyard behind the garage. Nobody can see this thing, and it's a very narrow shed that fits underneath the overhang. And they fined her for it, and then they assess penalties on top of the fine, and then they nailed her with attorney's fees, and now she's looking at foreclosure.
Jesus.
I mean, okay, there's one down in down by the Albertville Outlet Mall. Little mulchy thing right outside the front door, right up front in the front of the porch there area, and the lady planted the wrong type of flowers and got fined. Luckily, her husband is a real estate attorney, so that didn't make it very far. But nevertheless, this is becoming a very, very huge problem. And it's not only that, Representative Bonner and I have piles of cases that have been sent to us. And it used to be $100 a month or $140. Now it's $550 a month with no explanation of what it's – what. I mean, I get it. There's some inflationary factors, but in 6 years, it doesn't make any sense. And as our Mr. Foster testified to, it is over 80% of all new development now, and that seems to be a nationwide trend. I just learned that Arizona is getting on the same pathway and moving forward to nip this back a little bit.
Yeah. Representative Greenman?
Thank you, and I really appreciate it. I really appreciate the work of the bill authors in both, like, as I think about this and just the examples you used. You know, this is an example of when we sort of privatize governance, like when we think about local government, right? And if you get an assessment and there's an appeals process, and there's much of which we have put in statute or has been put in ordinance, because we think we want there to be fairness in how the decision making goes, we want there to be transparency, we require open meeting laws. To me, none of that is present when we talk about HOAs and some of the examples you talk about, which is like escalating fines and how do you even manage or appeal it. I think that the idea that local governments would be incentivizing or requiring this private governance is a problem. I really appreciate the work of this because, again, it seems to me if we're talking about stormwater, local governments have assessments that they can assess on individual properties. And if there's not enough of that, we should talk about how local governments can make sure to do what I think we all care about, which is assume that we have good stormwater practices and make sure that it is the folks who are paying for it are the folks who are living in those homes. So just really appreciate the work. I'd love to learn more. I know that there's been a task force, and Representative Bonner, you've been doing a ton of work on this. But it seems to me for this bill seems very common sense about just making sure that we aren't letting cities require forcing people into what is a non-transparent and pretty coercive infrastructure. So thank you. I will be voting yes on this roll call.
Representative Lee.
Well, thank you, Chair. I feel like Representative Greenman just articulated all the points I wanted to make about how we need to be cognizant of property taxes and the lack of transparency in HOAs, because they, you know, the nickname for that is like private government, right? And so really appreciate this work. I also do want to say I really agree with Chair Ekum's points as well, though. And I understand her hesitation with this, but since this is, you know, local gov, I hope that, you know, these concerns will be addressed in the housing committee. Because the other thing is, right, like, if this was a municipal entity, like, there'd be no problem having everyone's property taxes paid to maintain, you know, the stormwater pond or whatever. And I think this is again, like, a reason why we should not privatize government services. And so I'll be voting yes, but also do hope that the authors work to address this issue. Thanks.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I think I'll support this as well. But I'm curious, while I respect and appreciated Representative Akam's stormwater discussions, being a former mayor and council member, I understand that fully, and having a lot of my house is surrounded by swamps, I mean wetlands, that were created to build my house in neighborhoods. Does this, what? Representative Bonner and Mecklund, stormwaters, does that have anything to do in the bill, or was it just some good topics? I don't see how this has anything to do with stormwater. Does this prohibit cities or HOAs or anyone from planning those stormwaters? Or am I just confused on that? I don't confuse often, but
to the authors.
Yeah. No, it does not prevent them from building any kind of infrastructure that is necessary for the development. And to the point that I think Representative Mecklen made, in some cases, it is definitely in the builder's best interest to do the survey and do that as part of that review process. And if, of course, the terrain is such that it's very marshy, or that there may be issues with a lot of hard surfaces, a lot of water runoff, it would behoove them to do that, because certainly they do not want to be on the hook for folks with flooded basements. And I don't think that anyone would enjoy that, quite frankly. I would say, you know, some of the things we've kind of talked about here are part of the other 99% of this bill, which is, you know, that sort of idea around transparency, best practice, and consumer protections, and how do we get some parity for HOA owners in the same way in which we would for single family homes that don't fall under a CIC or an HOA. And certainly your example of the toys in the backyard. The other part of our bill would hopefully rein in some of that type of thing, because there are some crazy things that have happened. We've already done a few things around solar panels. We made it so that folks can have a home daycare business out of their home, which there were some HOAs that were forbidding the ability to care for children in a home. The new bill obviously will cover things like if you want to have a United States flag in your front yard, those kinds of issues too, or even just park your own vehicle in your driveway, which some HOAs do not allow for. Particularly if it's a work truck. And we certainly don't want folks to not be able to put food on their table and a roof over their head. So, but this specific piece of the bill is really just about saying, you know, we know that we sort of have an epidemic of HOAs, if you will. And there are certainly good reasons to have one. And we don't negate that. And that is fine. But what we're just saying here with this specific piece of legislation is, if it's not necessary, let's not create an additional pseudo form of government where there is maybe a lack of transparency and there isn't as much guardrails, or there's a larger ability for things to go awry. I am certain that folks in our cities do not want to have more complaints coming to them about HOAs. In fact, I hear that is one of their most dreaded complaints. And certainly every legislator in this room has no likely less than heard dozens of cases in the time they've been here of folks in their communities who are struggling with their HOA. And this is part of our first great effort to sort of put that transparency, best practice, and consumer protections in place. We have seen other states doing the same and trying to kind of rein it in a little bit and make sure consumers have those protections they need.
Well, additional question, and I want to thank the representative, because a lot of the members of this committee don't know what it's like being part of a swamp. When I think of water retention ponds, A lot of times that's to prevent flooding downstream. At least that's what was done in my areas. You had multiple retention ponds so that when it would catch and hold and prevent the rush of water down. Representative and Mr. Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Chair Quam. Thank you, Representative Meckland and Representative Bonner, for working on this. Representative Meckland, I haven't spoken to you about this, but I assume you've been working as hard as any bill author does on this. But I have spoken to Representative Bonner. I know you've spent dozens of hours on this and taken the input of stakeholders on this, and I really appreciate the work you've done. And I do think actually looking at the DE, the language on lines 1.18 and 1.19 kind of reflects some of that input. And that language allows cities to require maintenance or insurance of common elements such as stormwater ponds. So as Chair Akam noted, you know, one way a city can do that is to require the development to maintain a pond contractually. The developer may not be managing the subdivision anymore, but they would be a party to the contract. And, you know, as any lawyer here can say, contract law has well-established enforcement mechanisms. But local governments do actually have a couple other decision points that I think are worth mentioning here. So a city could vote no on approving the development if an amenity maintenance plan is insufficient. Second, it's worth mentioning that a city could assume ownership of any retention pond if it wanted to. I've seen a publication from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and it states, you know, it's a reasonable outcome that a local government could maintain an amenity like a stormwater pond versus making the private homeowners who live near it maintain it. And on a related note, I do think it's worth mentioning that the bill, as amended, has an effective date of January 1st of 2027. So it should only apply to ponds going forward, and cities are not retroactively required to maintain every existing pond. I have a huge amount of respect for Chair Akam's expertise in this area, and frankly, I get nervous when she raises questions like this, and I start second-guessing myself. But I do think with the language of the DE, the language is strong here. And it's also worth noting that if there are tweaks that need to happen to the language, it is going to another committee. It's not going to the general register, so there are still changes that can happen. I do think this issue of HOAs is one that needs to be addressed, and this is an important component of it. So I intend to vote yes on it.
Any other questions? I think two or three people haven't had any. All right. I will make the motion that House File 2614 be approved as amended and moved on to the Housing Committee. And please take the roll.
Chair Quam?
Yes.
Chair Freiberg?
Yes.
Vice Chair Altendorf?
Yes.
Vice Chair Lee?
Yes.
Representative Akam?
No.
Representative Coulter?
Aye.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Gordon?
Yes.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative McDonald?
Aye.
Representative Roach?
Yes.
Representative Vernig?
Aye.
And the ayes have it with a 11 to 1. So House File 2614 has been approved as amended and is moving on to the Housing Committee.
Thank you.
And our next author is approaching. And I believe that there is a testifier that is going to be connected through Zoom. And the author, introduce yourself and make your motion.
Thank you, Chair Quam. I'm Representative Jimmy Gordon, and I would like to move HF 3587 before the committee.
Proceed.
HF 3587 requires election judges assisting voters who can't enter the polling place to handle only one completed ballot at a time.
Are there questions or clarifications needed by committee members? Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, what is happening with this bill? Is it being laid over? Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Then the only comment I have, I appreciate your brevity. Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, are we in the discussion portion of the bill?
Okay. Yes.
Okay, great. Just wanted to clarify. So, it was so brief. I wanted to just ask the author to maybe tell us a little bit more about the problem that the bill is solving for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, take drive-up voting, for example, where folks aren't able to get out of their car. So you have election judges that are going out, and they're bringing completed ballots back into the polling location, feeding them into the machine, and then if you were to have an issue with that process, how do you know which ballot belongs to which person in a car if you had multiple people in that vehicle?
The author of clarification, this process requires two judges, so that way if there's two people in the car, each judge would know which person's ballot they had and could, that way you wouldn't have a under or not understood whose ballot was spoiled. And we also have online now from the Secretary of State's office, Ms. Freeman, and she probably can give some clarity as well. Did you want to introduce yourself, give your testimony, and maybe add further clarification to the question?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gordon. My name is Nicole Freeman. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Office of the Secretary of State. Your last comment was actually clarifying the way that I initially read the bill and the folks in our office read the bill is that election judges as a team would only be able to carry one voted ballot. So as Representative Gordon said, with curbside voting right now, it's often typical that oftentimes what we've heard is there's just one voter in the car. But yes, there can definitely be multiple voters in the car. And I understand the confusion is around, you know, if there was an overvote on a ballot or another mistake and that ballot was rejected, wanting to make sure who that ballot belonged to. And I think on this, again, I think I misunderstood the intent of the bill and was thinking that it was just the pair of election judges would have control over just one ballot. And so I think this is something that we're very open to continuing to discuss and work with you, Representative Gordon, on to make sure that there's clarity, whether or not it's in statute or in our guidance or both. But I think looking at, I haven't had a chance to get a lot of feedback from other counties to see sort of what other things might we not be thinking about in this situation. And so that is, I guess, my only flag of I was maybe misunderstanding the intent of the bill. And so we should definitely keep working on this to reduce confusion and make sure that the process can move as smoothly as possible. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. And, the author can clarify too. My interpretation of this bill is we don't want to deny a person a vote in a circumstance which if it was rejected, they would not then have a chance of redoing the ballot and having their vote. Is that the intent of the author?
Yes.
And because it's being laid over, there should be sufficient time for any additional or clarifying language to be added. Representative McDonald, you had a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Gordon, is this your first bill in this hearing?
Second.
Second?
Mm-hmm.
And did you bring treats, Representative?
I did. I received a hard time from the, everybody last time. It was my first time, and I bucked authority and tradition. And so this time I've got crumble cookies in the back corner there for anybody that wants them. So,
great. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. And I guess I had overlooked that technical question. And Representative Lee, did you have an additional question?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So I wanted to better understand the intent of the bill because it's not clear, as Ms. Freeman had indicated, what this would do. Because what I want to know is, like, if there's an instance, typically, right, what happens here is someone is maybe driving a parent to go vote with them and there are two ballots. So I wanted to understand, if this were to be enacted, does that mean then, right, like the team of judges would walk one ballot back and then come back to the car and walk the other back? Like, just want to understand how the mechanics would work.
And to the author, yeah, I'd clarify, because when I looked at it, I knew there were two judges, which means each one would be able to know whose ballot they were carrying, but please clarify.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the way that this says election judge is not election judge, right? So, I mean, I think there is definitely work that we can do with the Secretary of State's office to make sure we've got the appropriate language here, and glad to hear that they're willing to take a look at this. It's just we wanted to get the conversation started, and it was an issue that, you know, we've thought about and had kind of reported to us that could potentially be a problem, and we want to avoid confusion for our election judges and want to make sure everybody's vote counts.
Additional clarifications? Chair Freiberg.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Quam. Thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Gordon. Yeah, just kind of to follow up on Vice Chair Lee's point. I mean, I understand there's two election judges, but you can also think of, you know, you could just increase the number that in Representative Lee's hypothetical by one, and so, you know, say it's a voter with two of their parents, then, you know, I think. Anyway, the goal, I think, in asking these questions is just to make sure there isn't any delay, you know, especially in some elections, there's a lot happening. And I think if it is interpreted in a way that requires somebody to go to, you know, both election judges to bring one or two ballots back and then come back to the car and then get one or two more, I think we'd probably want to avoid that, just because, you know, we don't want to delay the election any longer than it does. So I hear you're willing to keep working on the language. It's getting laid over, so appreciate that, and just encourage you to connect with Ms. Freeman and see if there's ways it can be clarified, just to avoid that sort of eventuality. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And again, I commend the author with desiring to not have a person lose their vote because of a mistake, but as is very evident, clarification of this language does appear to need that work. And do you have any comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I think we're looking forward to getting it in the proper format and making sure that we don't delay, you know, the process any longer than it has to be, but we want to make sure it's done correctly and accurately. So.
Well, with that, this bill is laid over. And the author can move his next bill.
Thank you, Chair Quam. I would like to move HF 3589 before the committee. And HF 3589 would permit a voter to briefly leave a polling location to address an unexpected need at the discretion of the head election judge. So just to kind of give you an example that was brought to our attention was, you had a voter come in, spilled a drink on their pants and on their ballot, and before they could be given a new ballot, they left the room to go get themselves cleaned up. And when they came back, they were able to receive a new ballot and vote. But this language would provide some guidelines for unforeseen circumstances in situations like that. So I think we want to take as much of the guesswork out of things for our election judges as possible.
And Ms. Freeman, your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Quam, Representative Gordon. On this one, I think that our office is interested in, currently we feel like there is a bright line of when you come into the polling location and you've checked in and you've received your ballot. You certainly can spoil your ballot and receive a new one, you know, if a mistake is made or, you know, in the situation if something is spilled on it. But I think we're concerned with the broad discretion that, at the discretion of a head election judge, and the variability that would create across the state in practices. And also, I think we're concerned about potential errors or confusion that could come out of this, of, you know, how how would election judges track, understanding in this situation, right, it's very likely that the voter would come back. It was probably just, you know, a very short time period. But, you know, if it was, if it did happen more often, say someone got an emergency phone call and felt like they needed to leave, I think we would worry about this sort of piling up. And as election judges change shifts, how is it communicated? And then at the end of the day, are there balancing issues then because of that? And so I think this situation definitely shows an area where, you know, we'd be very happy to work with Representative Gordon and others to explore how we might be able to clarify what the guidance would be from the office and based in statute and rule for election judges in our election judge guidebook that we put out and update regularly. And so, but I think right now with the bill language as it's written, we would have concern just about the variability across the state, and that it would, right now we feel like there's a bright line that you're considered to have voted once you've received your ballot. Thank you. And yes, happy to talk more.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. And in my grilling of the author before the bill was being presented here, I understand that this came from election judges who said, hey, you know, we have this odd thing and we didn't see rules about it. You know, did you want to confirm for the committee this came from an actual election judge who had a situation?
Yeah, right. I mean, just this, thank you. Well, thank you, Chair Quam. But yeah, this came from a witnessed example that happened last time that voting was taking place. So, yeah, and I welcome Secretary of State's, you know, addition to language. I mean, I would agree that it's probably not quite where it needs to be yet, but it's something that we wanted to get the conversation started on.
Well, and this bill is going to be laid over. Mm-hmm. So there'll be discussions with this topic and others with the author, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I'm wondering if Ms. Freeman can just tell us what is the guidance currently for when a situation like this might arise at a polling place, probably both in early voting and then on election day.
Ms. Freeman.
Sure. On election day, like I said, I think the guidance is that once a voter has received their ballot, if they left the polling location, they would essentially be abandoning their ballot. They're already marked having voted. And so, you know, we certainly do occasionally across the state during a statewide election have a handful of folks who, for one reason or another, you know, walk out of the polling place without casting their ballot. But right now the guidance would be that, you know, those folks have signed in. And if anything like that would occur, you know, you document that on the incident log so that that could be explained later if there was, you know, a balancing issue there. So I don't know that as I was looking through things, I don't know that it is explicit to, you know, this type of situation where someone, you know, something happens more emergently. It's usually a case where someone is frustrated about something or confused about something, or for reasons we don't know, right? They walk out, and we usually don't have a lot of information about why they're leaving. As far as if someone is voting ahead of election day, again, if they're voting during the 18 days prior to election day, the same rule would apply in that they're being handed a ballot that will be then directly tabulated by a tabulation machine. And so their ballot would be considered, they would also be considered voted.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman.
Yeah.
Additional, Representative Lee?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think my... Well, thank you, Ms. Freeman, for providing that explanation. I think the concern here is just, I mean, when I think about this, I think about like taking a test, right? Like the SATs or the LSAT, right? Like you come in, you get your identity verified because they want to make sure you're the person taking the test. You want to make sure you're the person actually voting. you know, those are like highly controlled environments. I'm concerned about the implementation of something like this in a busier polling place and how you make sure that your tabulation at the end makes sense and also that people are actually coming back to vote on their ballot, right? So I understand the bill is being laid over, but want to make sure that we're addressing kind of these vulnerabilities that I see in the voting system. So I guess my question is, I don't know, Rep. Gordon, like, do you see where this could open up voting process to vulnerabilities?
To the author.
Not if we had voter ID, would be certainly helpful. But it's a good question, and I think that's certainly something that we need to consider as we're looking at this. But it's, you know, you want to make sure that everybody, nobody's disenfranchised, that if you did have something happen where you've been waiting in line, you need to use the bathroom, or you spill something, or, you know, the kid, you know, the new baby throws up on you or something like that. We want to be able to get people in there to vote, right? So, I think it's a valid concern, and I think that that's something that we'll need to look at and work with the Secretary of State's office to make sure that that's, you know, not a problem if we were to implement something like this.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you mentioning babies throwing up, because those of us who have young kids know how frequently and how poorly timed that can be sometimes. So I appreciate your willingness to work on this, and I want to compliment you on your brevity. I'm sure when you were mayor, your city council meetings didn't go to 11 o'clock at night like mine did sometimes. The phrase, frankly, that I just have the biggest concern about is this question of discretion of the head election judge. Mm-hmm. I understand sort of the intent behind it, but, you know, thinking about, like, when I go to vote at my precinct, you know, we have relatively large precincts, a couple hundred voters, but folks still know their neighbors, and I'm thinking particularly, you know, in smaller precincts where you may only have a couple of dozen. My concern is that if it is at the discretion of the head election judge, these are our neighbors, right? And the vast majority of folks are good folks who will do right by all voters. But my fear is that it only takes a couple of bad actors to use that discretion, I think, in a way that I don't think you would want, and I don't think any of us would want. And so that sort of, like Ms. Freeman said, that sort of variability gets me just a little bit concerned. So I would just kind of add that to your list of things to think about and work on. Thank you.
I'm not seeing any other questions, so if the author would have closing comments.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your guys' time. Thank you, Chair Quam and members of the committee, and looking forward to continuing to work on these. Thanks for the feedback.
And with that, the bill is laid over.
Chair Quam, if you'd like to move your bill and describe it to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would move House File 3588 for possible inclusion. And basically, this is to realize that there, you know, on even-numbered years, there are federal elections on the ballot and state elections on the ballot, and oftentimes the major parties do a cooperative effort on this federal, you know, the congressional and other races, and that this would allow currently only Minnesota residents, so the state would have somebody request the list. And that would be shared into the database that's used, especially in these federal races. And this would allow for the head of the major party at the federal level to be able to get the update to the database so that all of the Minnesota CDs and the state party would have a up-to-date and active database. And that would work for any of the major parties. Currently, I think we just have two in the state with national organizations.
Thank you, Chair Quam. Members, do you have any questions on the bill? Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as I was thinking about this, you mentioned our two major political parties, but actually one of our major parties is currently chaired by a registered voter in Minnesota, so it wouldn't actually make any difference at this point. But I'm just sort of curious what, I mean, couldn't the chair of a major political party just call someone who is a registered voter in the state and get the list that way? I don't necessarily have a problem with this. I'm just curious sort of what the need is that this bill addresses.
Chair Quam.
Thank you. And this would be so the chair of the DNC or the RNC would be able to initiate these data requests. Currently, it is being done by having a resident of the state. And this would basically that's a additional step that's required. But when, you know, there's special regulations about campaign funding and spending and activities that are in a federal race where there's some slight differences from how the state's done. And so there's generally a cooperative effort to make sure that, you know, maybe your CD is involved, the state party is involved, but the whole database is frequently hosted or coordinated by the DNC, RNC, for the, you know, on these federal races. And so this would just make it allowable for, you know, for them to directly get these updates. And I think it would help and assist, you know, both of the major parties because it's meant to just make it, you know, more straightforward for them. It's not going to, not passing this won't prevent things happen, but it just makes it a little more streamlined. At one time, I was a CD chair, and I became informed of the intricacies of the federal race versus, you know, and you have to have things separate and organized. It's a complex system, both in our state and then on the federal level. And this is meant to make it a little bit more straightforward and easy. It's not adding any new data or anything like that. It's just realizing that this is going on and trying to facilitate that for the two major parties.
No follow-up? Any other questions? No? Closing comments, Chair Quam?
Thank you for your time. And with that, I lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Okay, thank you. And with that, HF 3588 will be laid over. And members, we are adjourned.